Only dirt and rock.
This has to be it. The distance is right, the size is right. And the map only showed one canyon.
Maybe the water didn't back up this far.
Or the reservoir has been drawn down considerably since Armageddon.
It's also possible that the dam's been breached and that either the river's dried up or it's running deep underground.
Tipping his hat brim to block the glare of the sun, JB looked down the gorge in the direction of the dam.
The water might still be there, below our line of sight in the canyon bottom.
Even if the river has dried up, low spots in the bed could hold standing pools. The deepest part of a reservoir is usually at the base of its dam. Even if the dam's broken, there could still be plenty of water trapped in front of it.
Our best hope for finding water is the canyon. We've got to follow it. We better get moving. Cover as much ground as we can before the sun gets high.
There was no discussion about whether to descend to the canyon floor. In fact, the subject didn't even come up. Although walking along the rim was a much longer trek because of the short side canyons they had to skirt, it was also the high ground, and that gave them a tactical advantage. They couldn't be pinned down and ambushed on the rim. About a half mile down canyon, they came to a wide flat spot that had been cleared of rocks. They would have walked right past it if Mildred hadn't spoken up.
Hey, wait a minute! We got ourselves a field here, a cultivated field.
Doc stared at the empty patch of dirt, bounded by boulders.
Not in recent memory, my dear.
The field is a remnant of prehistoric agriculture. 1,000 years ago, the local cliff dwellers grew crops on top of these canyons in plots just like that. There should be a path somewhere around here down to their cave.
There.
Jack pointed out a shiny, shallow groove worn in the bedrock. It led away to the apex of the side canyon ahead.
This is important, Mildred?
Storage wells, Christy. All the ancient settlements had them. The residents hauled water up from the river and stored it in stone cisterns in their caves. They also built catch basins and channels that fed rainwater from the plain down to their wells. These cisterns were always covered and in shade. There could be some water left from the last rain, whenever that was. I know it's a long shot.
It's worth a look, anyway.
The prehistoric path ended at the cliff edge. The companion stared down at a steep, rubble-filled chute. The scree of large rocks had been tossed from above, forming crude steps, which turned around a bend 50 feet below and vanished from sight. Ryan and the others carefully descended, as the loose rocks shifted under their weight. Around the blind corner, a sandstone ledge jutted from the canyon wall. They followed the narrow walkway along the face of the overhanging cliff. It was a long, straight drop to the bottom, at least 200 feet. The ledge led them to a broad, shallow cave with a towering, arched ceiling. The cliff-dweller ruins were barely recognizable as such. From their deteriorated condition, it was obvious that the reservoir had covered them at one time. The sun-dried bricks had melted. The two- and three-story structures had collapsed. Mud and stick pueblos weren't designed to be submerged and then subjected to wave action. When the dammed waters had retreated, they had done so with enough force to wash away the stone foundations of the buildings closest to the ledge. The covered cistern lay at the back of the cave, where the ceiling sloped down to meet the floor, a wide, circular, 5-foot-deep pit, lined with flat, tightly fitted stones. At the bottom of the well, spread across its lowest corner, was about a gallon of liquid. Brown liquid. Ryan hopped down into the pit and put a finger in it. It was thick, slimy between his fingers. It didn't smell bad, though.
We're going to have to boil the hell out of that stuff before we try to drink it.
Better start scrounging up some wood for a fire, JB.
JB, Doc, and Jack immediately set about kicking apart a surviving 13th century mud daub wall, this to pull out the mat of dry sticks that reinforced it. Anasazi rebar. Mildred and Christy joined Ryan in the bottom of the cistern. The three of them got down on their knees and sopped up the precious moisture with rags, then carefully squeezed it, drop by drop, into their battered tin cookpot. Before trying to boil the mess, they filtered it through several layers of clean fabric. This removed the bigger chunks, but it was still brown, still thick, the water of last resort. While it bubbled and frothed in the pot, the companions moved to the edge of the ledge and took in the spectacular view.
The people who lived up here must have thought they ruled the world. They built, they farmed, they stored for hard times. They prospered. And now, there's nothing left. Not even ghosts. It makes me think of that sad, sad poem. I forget the title.
You are referring to Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's right, Doc.
Words found inscribed among decaying ruins, buried in drifting sands.
Science blows.
Bravo. You have it precisely, dear Ryan. It is nothing less than the paradigm of human existence, forever blinded by our pride and victims of the inexorable march of time.
Over there.
JB pointed up at the sky. They all turned to look. The buzzards, perhaps 30 of them in all, were mere specks in the distance down canyon. Circling in a low spiral at 3,000 feet, the carrion birds became visible one by one as they turned and were momentarily sidelit by the sun.
Something's below them for sure, Ryan.
From the height they're flying, something's not quite dead enough.
Shotgun.
Shit. That boil's gonna have to do. Fill up the canteens and kick out the fire. Let's move.
After scrambling back to the canyon rim, Ryan led the others at a full-out trot, despite the building heat and the now-dead still air. Out of food and on scant rations of barely potable water, the companions absorbed this new punishment without complaint. The buzzards weren't a good sign, but at least one person was alive. If they waited until evening to investigate, they might never catch up to whoever had fired the shot. And that could mean the difference between life and a very unpleasant death. As Ryan ran, he kept his eye on the flock of buzzards, watching them slowly descend from altitude, then spiral down into the canyon out of sight. He marked the spot ahead where they disappeared. There was no more gunfire. The shooter was either out of ammo or out of luck. It took 5 minutes to close the gap. The canyon beside them had grown much wider, if not deeper. It was impossible to miss the vultures against the beige of the dirt and rock. Black feathers, 7-foot wingspans, angry red heads. A mob of them, fighting over the spoils. Ryan flipped up the lens covers on his telescopic sight and scanned the crude campsite. He counted 4 sets of human legs half hidden under the flapping wings and snapping beaks. Legs that were kicking, shuddering amid the frenzy.
All dead?
Let's find out.
Ryan tucked the Steyr tight to his shoulder and squeezed off a 7.62mm round. The bolt gun bucked hard, and downrange, a lone buzzard exploded in a puff of blood and dark feathers. As the loose bag of bones tumbled to the ground, the other birds abandoned their feeding positions. Squawking, flapping, they hopped to the safety of nearby rocks. Ryan surveyed the now still human forms through the scope.
Yep, they're all dead.
Shooter must have taken off.
Can't tell from up here.
Ryan handed the Steyr to his friend.
Jack and me are gonna have a look-see. Watch your backs.
Gotcha.
They found and followed a narrow chimney of rock that led to the canyon floor and the gruesome campsite. 4 of the bodies were clustered together. The 5th lay a short distance away.
Been dead a while.
Because of the heat, it was hard to say how long. The torsos and limbs were swollen up like balloons with the gases of decay. 2 of the bodies that lay on their backs had actually burst open, exposing sun-shriveled, sun-blackened guts. The buzzards had stripped the flesh from all 4 of the faces. Red, eyeless skulls poked out from fringes of hair and sagging skin. It was impossible to tell what they died from. With no hint of breeze to shift the overpowering stench, it took a supreme effort of will not to turn away. That stink had ridden the canyon thermals, soaring high, spreading far and wide, attracting carrion feeders for hundreds of miles. As Ryan and Jack moved to look at the 5th body, the big birds shifted their perches on the surrounding boulders, brooding, watching, wary, waiting their chance to resume the feast.
This one's fresh.
The last dead man lay on his side in the dirt. So far, he had been left alone by the vultures. They preferred their meat, aged to the point of liquefaction. It was the shooter, no doubt about it. Ryan picked up the shotgun. It was a single shot, top break, 12-gauge, with an exposed hammer. Cheap, long-barreled gun. Mass-produced in the hundreds of thousands in the century before Armageddon. He tried the brake lever. It moved, but the breech wouldn't open because it had been crudely welded shut. Somebody had converted the weapon from center fire to black powder muzzle loader. Not an unusual modification in Deathlands, where black powder was easier to find than cased ammunition. Ryan sniffed the barrel. It had been recently fired, with devastating effect. The dead man had put muzzle under his chin and then depressed the trigger. There was a stick on the ground beside his hand. He might have used it to get the necessary extra reach. His head was a massive, powder-scorched ruination. The front of his face gone, from chin to mid-cranium. His brain pan emptied. The hollow glistened. Ryan and Jack did a quick survey of the gear that lay scattered around the site. They found a few meager valuables. Battered black powder weapons, skinning knives sharpened down to slivers, cooking utensils, empty canvas packs. The bodies hadn't been stripped of clothing and boots. There were the remains of a fire pit, but no food scraps among the ashes. No food, period. Of course, they could have eaten it all before they got this far. The one-eyed man scratched the black stubble on his chin.
What's missing?
The answer came to him at once. Canteens. There were no containers. Nothing to hold water.
Something triple ugly happened here. No one tries to cross the desert without something to carry water in.
Footprints go that way.
Jack pointed in the direction of the dam.
One set. Big feet. Deep marks. Short steps. Heavy load.
Blackheart son of a bitch took all their water and ran. They chased him until they dropped.
Jack knelt over the footprints in the powdery dust. The wind had eroded them.
2, maybe 3 days old.
That doesn't mean he's got a full 3-day lead on us. The load he's carrying had to have slowed him down. He probably stopped to rest, figuring these fools were done for.
Catch chiller, take water.
Ryan nodded. The albino didn't have to add, leave the thieving bastard to die. That was a given. Rough justice was the only justice in Deathlands. The dead man's gear wasn't worth the trouble to lug it away. Ryan and Jack took the time to drag the suicide over to a nearby undercut in the dry riverbank. They rolled him into the shallow notch, then kicked the soil down on top of him. They didn't try to move the other bodies. The corpses would have just fallen apart, and there was always the chance of contagion from rotting flesh. Ryan and Jack started back up the rock chimney. The extinguished torch dropped from Yuld Star's shock-stiffened fingers. Pain squeezed him like a giant fist, making every muscle bulge, every sinew strain to the snapping point. Unmasterable pain. As he hopped in the dancing half-light, a torrent of humid air poured from the gash, driven forth by whatever was coming. The scent that rode that evil wind triggered something deep in his brain, something primal. An unfamiliar taste, metallic and sour, flooded his mouth. The taste of panic and of imminent, crushing defeat. Worse suffering was on its way. Much, much worse. Yuld shoved Tolliver and his lit torch ahead of him.
Go! Go!
The direction didn't matter. To stand still was to die. The four of them raced away, running blindly into the black maw of the corridor. Dunbar couldn't maintain the pace for more than a few yards before falling behind. Bringing up the rear, with nothing between him and whatever it was, his grunting turned frantic.
Oh, help me! Come back, help me!
Yuld, Tolliver, and Wiljay didn't look back.
No, not again! Make it stop!
They didn't stop. In fact, they somehow found the strength to run faster. And Yuld wasn't the only one praying for it to take Dunbar, to take him and choke. A cowardly prayer, promptly answered.
Oh, fuck!
Yuld knew there was no guarantee that the thing would be satisfied with Dunbar, that it wouldn't pursue and chill them one by one. Like the stairwell, the hallway was a kill zone. They had to get out of it, and quick. Over Tolliver's right shoulder, Yuld saw a double doorway.
In there!
They burst through the heavy metal doors and onto a short concrete landing that overlooked a room so broad and so cavernous they couldn't see the far side of it. Overhead, the undersides of steel I-beam trusses and buttresses were dimly visible. The network of their upper surfaces and the ceiling were beyond the reach of torchlight. Smell of death was like a sledgehammer pounding inside Yuld's head.
Man, look at your arm!
What?
You're hurt triple bad!
Yuld's right arm had ballooned up to nearly twice its normal size and turned black, but it no longer pained him. He couldn't move his grossly swollen fingers, and he couldn't bend or raise the arm. hanging straight down from his shoulder. It felt like it weighed 100 pounds. When he tested his forearm with a fingertip, there was no sensation, and the spongy flesh didn't spring back. The pressure left a deep dent and split the skin, like it was already dead meat. For a second, Ewald thought he was going to puke.
You better give me that blaster. You're in no shape to use it.
Ewald grimaced at the Greybeard's shaking hands. No way could Tolliver aim the Uzi. He probably couldn't even fire it. Not that the ex-Mercy would have willingly surrendered his weapon anyway.
Don't worry about me, Tolliver. I can shoot Lefty just fine. We gotta keep moving. Gotta find another way down.
The landing's short flight of steps led to a polished concrete floor. Beyond the hazy circle of light cast by the torches, it was pitch black. At Ewald's direction, they turned and speedwalked in a straight line until they reached a wall.